Business model F-up number 4. Codependency collapse. In any other aspect of life, true codependency can be a hindrance to personal growth and development. The same is true in the business world. Does your startup rely on relationships within a single industry, or worse yet, a single client, in order to succeed? If so, you've got a problem. For a hypothetical example, let's say you're making video games that only work on the PlayStation platform. This might be great in some respects. PlayStation, for now, is a successful company with deep pockets. They're already educated about what their consumers want. And without a doubt, they have established systems for working with suppliers like you. The problem you face when you make PlayStation your only client is that you're reliant on an ecosystem that could someday collapse. As unlikely as it seems, PlayStation could go bankrupt, leaving you out in the cold. Or more likely, some structural change, business, technology, or otherwise, could hinder your access to the platform. Take what used to be my son's favorite drug, the mega-hit game Fortnite, for example. Back in 2020, Epic, the game's creator, took Apple to court after Apple kicked the game off its App Store. Epic had launched a new direct payment system in the app that bypassed Apple's cut, thus breaking their rules. Epic alleged that Apple violated antitrust law. Had Epic only offered their blockbuster game on Apple's App Store platform, they would be sunk, especially once the judge ruled that Apple couldn't remove Epic's developer account, but Apple was also under no obligation to reinstate the game on the App Store. I've experienced codependency collapse more than once. At the beginning of this chapter, I told you about my company Shockwaved, which suffered because I made the mistake of relying on advertising agencies to connect me with my in-game clients. If I'd broadened my client base to encompass the agencies and the brands I ultimately created games for, I would have retained more control of my pricing structure, kept a greater percentage of my fees, and forged relationships in multiple industries, not only within the advertising world. I should have known better than to commit this failure. Years earlier, I'd had a job creating special effects for advertising agencies. I loved the work, but it didn't last, because the company that employed me, Sun Film, only created special effects for commercials, their revenue nosedived when the advertising market collapsed. This was my first experience with codependency F-up. The head of product at Sun Film at the time, Ulla Rordam, explained to me how Sun was caught in the codependency trap as a sub-supplier to the advertising industry. With only a limited number of avenues to utilize for clients, if the advertising budgets plummeted, so did Sun's workforce, budget, and market share. In a similar manner, the tremendously skilled television producer, Thomas Huerlin, owner of Impact TV and a very dear friend, only has a handful of direct customers, as there were not that many Danish broadcasters to approach with each new television format. This requires a massive balancing act. It wasn't actually until I founded my first company that I truly understood the pain points of being stuck in a codependency situation. Those familiar with the tech industry likely know what a single point of failure, SPOF, is. It's that part of a system that, if it fails, will halt the workings of the entire system. Think back before cloud mirroring of a hard drive. If that hard drive failed, the entire machine stopped working and everything on the drive was lost. Looking at Epic and Apple, it's easy to see that had Apple's App Store been the main distribution point for Fortnite, the whole operation would have fallen apart. To better understand this SPOF concept, take Lookery, an information farming service that provided statistic showcasing services to large social media sites. Founded by Scott Rafer, David Cancel, Rex Dixon, and Todd Sawicki in 2007, Lookery received two funding rounds from over 20 investors. At the core, Lookery had a major vulnerability. Built as a no-frills banner network for Facebook app publishers, Lookery failed to consider any future design changes the social media giant might roll out. When Facebook did it in 2008, Lookery was forced into playing catch-up to stay viable. Rather than look for an exit solution, Lookery attempted to rethink their strategy and solution without success. It was closed and purchased by AdKnowledge later that year. Similarly, in 2007, the four management consultants, Ariel Diaz, Jeff Hebert, Matt Hodgson, and Brad Johnson, founded Ucaster, a video platform that aimed to sell video content online. The platform offered a new way for video broadcasters and online content producers to make money by selling live broadcasts, on-demand videos, and video downloads found nowhere else online. The company's initial success came by way of partnerships with high schools and colleges. They produced live and on-demand offerings for school sporting events that wouldn't otherwise be televised on traditional television networks. As the market focus shifted to include an open market of video content producers looking to sell live and pre-recorded products to consumers, the company was hesitant to pivot. The founders feared alienating their loyal customer base, but when the business model finally changed focus, they realized the market was non-existent. The founders spent countless working hours attempting to acquire fundraising to carry the company through. But within 2 years, the economic downturn made angel investors scarce. In a last-ditch effort, the founders put all their expectations on partnerships with large companies in the hope of creating a lasting relationship to provide Ucaster much-needed support and longevity to survive. Unlike startups, the large independent companies moved too slowly to approve and fund Ucaster, resulting in its death. I'm sure by now you're seeing the constant thread here. Perhaps you even hear an elder relative's voice whispering in your mind, "Don't put all your eggs in one basket." Either way, codependency and SOPF issues will sink a company faster than the iceberg that took down the Titanic. For a slight variation on the SOPF failure, I offer you Barings Bank. This particular case study shows how a SOPF doesn't only apply to new companies. In 1762, Barings Bank began at the hands of a wool merchant from Exeter and his father, John Francis Baring, who started the John and Francis Baring Company. Within a few years, they had offices in Cheapside, London, and the Mining Lane District, and helped finance the United States government during the War of 1812. After more than 200 years as a powerful entity, the company was brought to its knees in 1995 by a massive trading loss committed via fraud by 28-year-old Nick Leeson, a former chief executive and current employee. Without any oversight of his trading activities, he could hide his bets in Singapore by reporting it to the London branch as profit. The loss escalated at an unprecedented pace due to internal and external factors unrelated to the fraud. To cover his behind, he changed a branch error account in the office and blamed one of his colleagues for purchasing 20 contracts on a buy-and-sell basis, costing the company £20,000 each. By December of 1994, Leeson had cost over £200 million on top of the additional £102 million reported to Britain's tax authorities. Allowing one person so much power without oversight was the SOPF that sent Barings Bank to its grave. The fix? Diversify. I'm not saying that one couldn't make millions creating content for PlayStation alone. What I am saying is that one shouldn't count on making millions creating content solely for PlayStation. If you're this hypothetical game maker, you'll want to consider branching out and creating games for Xbox and a few other platforms as well. You could do this using the superb gaming platform Unity, which we'll return to later under organizational failures as an example fix. You'll probably also want to distribute your product directly to your end clients, cut out the middleman. Once you've covered those bases, you can think about building diversification and expansion into your business's 5- and 10-year plans. Remember to always be on the lookout for a single point of failure or codependency concern. If you determine you're already in one of those situations, you need to take action now. Here are some steps to avoid allowing one big customer to dictate the future of your entire business. Size doesn't matter that much. Even if a customer is large, they aren't entitled to all your attention. You are in control of which customer segments you choose to work with. Make sure you can quickly adapt your strategy to the size of the customer and the acquisition costs. It's completely fine to start with smaller customers, but keep in mind point number two. Customization kills. Offering each customer ultimate customization is a timely venture that rarely nets the return you want. Ensure you have a reliable product and a command of the market before offering any customizations. If you plan to find a solid foothold in your industry, you will need a solution that applies more generically with only minimal customizations available, if any. You can't serve one person all the time. Limiting yourself to only one customer who monopolizes all your time and resources will send your doors closing faster than you can imagine. You'd be better off having many smaller customers rather than one large one. Remember, good news travels. So the more small, happy customers you have, the more potential new customers you'll have knocking on your door. Save your capital for creation. The temptation to upgrade your office suites, create fancy new video ads by a young creative director, and so on can kick you in the backside. As you grow, save your capital to create improvements for your products or services. These can be pricey if they require hiring new people, finding new suppliers, or making capital improvements. Don't micromanage. No matter what your product needs, you've hired the best of the best to make it happen. Let them do what they do best. Back up and let them do their jobs. Don't fall into the micromanagement trap because it stifles creativity, productivity, and innovation. A final note on diversification. If it's unavoidable that your company will cater to a single industry, then make sure your business plan spells out exactly how you'll defend your company if your primary marketplace crashes. Business model F-up number 5. Terrible timing. Who knows the cliche, timing is everything? Like most cliches, this one is true. Understanding your industry gives you great timing insight. It sounds obvious, but I'll remind you anyway. Please be mindful of your timing. A quick check-in with our data paints a grim but obvious picture of the packed startup cemetery following the burst of the dot-com bubble from roughly 2000 to 2003 and another dip at the Great Recession around 2007 to 2009 with fewer investments, less job creation by startups, and so on. And then we're just getting warmed up with today's interesting business climate. Factor in how long it's going to take you to bring your fantastic idea to the marketplace. If you're making a physical product, how long will it take to create the designs, produce your samples, refine them, turn all of that work into a saleable commodity, and distribute it? Is your industry regulated? And if so, how long will it take you to get your final product approved? Timing is everything. It's a cliche for a reason. Take the e-retailer Boo.com that launched in late 1999. Ready to go with an online outlet offering specialty and branded sportswear, Boo.com had direct agreements with the production teams for the products, owned offices and distribution centers in 4 countries, serviced 6 different countries, and had over 200 employees at launch. Lest we forget to mention the high-tech website, it offered 3D images, Flash, and a virtual assistant who acted as a personal stylist. This well-thought-out venture, technologically advanced for the time, couldn't get off the ground for a few important timing reasons. First, their advanced features for their online sportswear shop required web users to have broadband internet. While the site serviced customers in huge markets like the US and Europe, less than 2% of the households in these countries had broadband service. In preparation for their launch, the founders sank a ton of money into advertising and marketing before their product was market ready. This led to release delays and, ultimately, a loss of potential customers who attempted to utilize the service prior to the actual go-live date. This sad start for clothing retailers online ended a scant few months later for Boo.com. Only 7 years later, the clothing, shoes, and accessories market won the first place slot for all articles being sold on the internet. Boo.com is a prime example of a business ahead of its time and not ready for its marketplace. A lesser-known example of terrible timing is Haburi.com. A Danish company launched almost simultaneously as Boo.com in early 2000. They offered an online outlet shopping experience. I helped develop various campaigns for Haburi.com via my company at the time, Shockwaved. And judging by the solid campaign budgets back then, you could tell they were in a hurry. Like Boo.com, they had contracts with the manufacturers, but they stood out by offering low prices to consumers looking to get the outlet pricing with an online shopping experience. After posting a large deficit in their first year and the dot-com crash, Haburi.com hoped to pull it together during their second year. Unfortunately, problems with investors as well as departing founders kept them from becoming profitable. In 2003, it was handed over to an established German textile company at a loss of $1 million per month during its time alive. Remember the poultry exchange? Beyond the idiot industry failure, they also had the misfortune of bad timing. As luck would have it, they also won the double whammy lottery by entering the market around the same time a major antitrust lawsuit wreaked havoc on poultry pricing. I'm pretty sure if I mention the online coupon site Groupon, over 90% of you listening right now could tell me what the company does. However, if I mention letsbuyit.com, I would assume the response would be completely different. Letsbuyit.com was a pan-European service offering group buying discounts to customers. Sound familiar? It should. And it entered the marketplace in 1999, a whopping 9 years before Groupon.com. Can you venture a guess as to why this online startup failed? You guessed it. Bad timing. When Letsbuyit.com launched, not only were there not many small businesses online, there also weren't many consumers. The build-it-and-they-will-come approach totally backfired for Lars Johan Magnus Stell von Holstein, the founder. I can only imagine how he felt when, years later, Groupon arrived in the marketplace and became a huge success. One last classic example of the terrible timing failure is brought to us by Hummer. This company launched a street version of the military gas guzzler in 1992, just before the climate crisis became a topic of international concern. Initially designed by AM General, the Hummer was used by troops during the Persian Gulf War and in Panama. During conflict news coverage, the vehicles were often featured and quickly gained popularity with celebrities such as Arnold Schwarzenegger, who bought a fleet. These hunkering vehicles were a novelty to be seen, but weighing in at over 10,000 pounds, they were an expensive vehicle to drive. Getting less than 10 miles per gallon with the original H1, the customer base was small. While the truck included some creature comforts separate from the military counterparts, like comfortable passenger seating and air conditioning, they didn't take the market by storm as planned. Sold to GM in 1999, a smaller version, the H2, was released on the market, boasting all the power with a lighter frame. A mere 2 years later, the world found itself amid an oil crisis. With the fuel cost skyrocketing, the cool factor Hummers offered was lost to other SUVs' practicality. But did GM pivot? No, they doubled down and designed the H3. It was smaller and lighter than the H2, but still got less than 15 miles per gallon on the road. By 2009, GM filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and the Hummer line was discontinued. Arriving late in the game, the first electric Hummer hit the market some 15 years later in an effort to resurrect the brand. Only time will tell how far their battery-powered re-envision of the former military vehicle will fare. Oh, and Arnold Schwarzenegger? He has also changed gears, now building awareness of the climate crisis and having founded the Schwarzenegger Climate Initiative. The fix? Be nimble. I know, without the advent of a crystal ball, or magic eight ball, as we will talk a bit about in Chapter 9, how does one truly overcome bad timing? The reality is, sometimes you get lucky. Other times it's all about planning and researching your market. If you do everything right and timing works against you, there's not much you can do other than be ready to pivot. Creating a layer of flexibility in your business plan can go a long way toward heading off any potential timing situations. If you know anything about technology, you've heard of if-then statements. Heck, you might even know them from spreadsheet programs or math classes some of us prefer to forget. Regardless, an if-then statement addresses the potential of a hypothesis or question with a solution. For example, if it rains and I don't have my umbrella, then I will get wet. Building these basic statements into your business plan can go a long way toward planning for the unforeseeable future. Mind you, some of those statements should address aspects related to timing. Say if your product launches and the internet dies, how will you get it in front of consumers? Is there a point when you have exhausted your planning and need to cut bait? Companies who build these components into their business planning stage tend to be more prepared in the event life hands them a ton of lemons. Those are the companies that don't try to get by making lemonade like everyone else. No, they make margaritas, lemon squares, lemon-crusted fish dishes, you name it. They have a plan and are willing to be flexible. Business model F-up number 6. Mini mindset. Entrepreneurs have a tendency to think too big in early stages of a startup, but many startups fail because the founders think too small too soon. Please plan on your business going places. Sorry, flower shop founders, I'm going to use you as an example again. It is not okay to tell yourself, all I need is to have a cozy little flower shop on the corner that makes just enough money to pay my bills until I die. You need to aim much higher. Not only because it would be nice to strike gold, but also because you actually do need to make more than enough to pay the bills until you die. You need to build a buffer into your business plan to account for all the things that will go wrong once you open your doors. If you're a business school student or graduate, you already know that I'm not being pessimistic. There are two problems here. One, thinking a small profit is okay. It's not. Something will go wrong, and then the small gain becomes a slight loss. Two, thinking too small in terms of what is possible. Why make a local kids' company walking dogs if you could almost equally make a nationwide dog walking company hiring kids? It's nearly the same work, but 100 times the result if it works. Unforeseen obstacles are inevitable, not because you didn't do your homework, but because stuff happens. Change is constant. There will be days when you don't get the 20 customers a day through the store you need to make a modest profit. There will be days when you get 3 customers. There will be unforeseen weather events that drive the wholesale price of tulips through the roof. There will be broken refrigerators, for which you didn't allot repair costs. As they said once upon a time in the Old West, there will be blood. And if you think small from the get-go, when challenges arise, you'll be dead, end of story. Bottom line, if you start your business thinking of it only as a small business, you've already sealed your fate in 99.8% of the cases. Granted, that statistic may be skewed, but the reality is if you decide your business will be small because the idea of thinking big is too scary or overwhelming or far-fetched, you'll be setting yourself up for possibly a quick flash-in-the-pan success if you hit the market right, followed by a sudden exit, leaving the customers you gained with a bad taste in their mouths over your lack of concern for their long-term dependence on your product or service. Or, more realistically, you'll be too buried under the fear of thinking too big is bad to grow and improve your business, products, and customer promise. It's the business equivalent to cutting off your nose to spite your face. Don't make the mistake of pigeonholing yourself into being a small business out of fear. This particular failure was one I witnessed. My parents owned a small laundromat next door to my childhood home, as well as others locally. As long as they brought in enough funds to pay for family vacations and extras, my parents were happy. Despite my parents having an entrepreneurial spirit, they always looked at those pursuits as additional income or a way to fill gaps and find some small growth, rather than a true lifestyle or career choice. Interestingly enough, their laundromats were my first glimpse into the potential of a subscription model. The idea of having a business that could run on autopilot intrigued me. Had they chosen to devote more time to their business ventures, along with applying growth formulas, they could have both given up their day jobs and perhaps enjoyed a different level of success and accomplishment. The fix. Apply the 10X rule and skip small. The 10X rule, which we could also nickname the anti-fragile rule, inspired by Wall Streeter and scholar Nassim Nicholas Taleb, for reasons I'll soon explain, starts with a simple calculation. The core idea is to stop shooting for average and instead multiply your goals by 10. It's the most straightforward math you'll do when creating your business plan. Just 10X everything. Once you've determined how much you'll need to make in sales to pay your bills, multiply that amount by 10. Now, develop improvements that will increase your revenue by tenfold. And there you have it, your new business model. Perhaps 10X reminds you of the BHAG, Big, Hairy, Audacious Goal, as coined by Jim Collins. And yes, it sounds simple, but the idea is good because it forces you to look at your goals in a different way and actually includes both the effort, consider it 10x harder, and account for that, and the desired result. Like a runner's bones, which get stronger when subjected to stress, your business will thrive on chaos if you've properly braced and buffered for it. That's what the anti-fragile rule does. Ups your ambitions in tandem with your prospects for success. Flower shop founder, I can already hear your argument. I just wanted to net $100,000 a year. That's all I need. And besides, there's no such thing as a boutique florist making $1 million. Get real. To that, I say two things. One, if you can't find a way to multiply revenue by 10, you shouldn't start this business. It will be too fragile and it will fail. Likewise, if you dream of a comfortable life that doesn't fit with what it will take to make that 10x leap from a fragile business to an anti-fragile company, it's possible the startup life might not be for you. That said, two, I want you to try it anyway. Think outside the box to find your ideal way to get to 10x growth. Yes, it will seem unrealistic at first because everything seems unrealistic before achieving it for the first time. Look at 1-800-Flowers. They bring in over $80 million yearly. It can be done. Skip thinking too small in different categories. Targeting niche markets is a successful approach that startups agree works. Most people misinterpret the word niche to mean small. However, it actually refers to a specialized segment of the market, your nest. Just because your target market segment is specialized doesn't mean it's small and limiting for your growth. In fact, if you position yourself properly, you can create a brand that scales beautifully from niche market into larger markets. Keep in mind, your product or service needs to be scalable to succeed beyond a niche market starting point. If you find that your product or service isn't scalable at any point in your launch process, you should understand you're only selling a product and not a business concept. A strong business concept is scalable, answers a problem with mass market appeal, and can potentially gain global influence. Flexibility is key. No thought is too small. you should always have an avenue for growth and development within your company. Open your eyes to look beyond today, tomorrow, and next week, and plan big. Create the roadmap to gaining widespread inclusion in your market. Seek out new partners, opportunities, marketing ventures, customers, products, and inspiration. In doing so, you'll change a small thinking mindset into one of possibility. In that, you may even happen upon something you never expected, a new and improved you. Think big. Don't limit your potential. Remember Roger Bannister, the first person in history to run a mile in under 4 minutes? Remember how long it took someone to beat Bannister's record time of 3 minutes, 59.4 seconds? That's right, 46 days. Everything is impossible until it's not. A final word on business models. So, now that you know how to ensure you have a viable business model for a product in an attractive industry that solves real problems customers have, which alone could save you from startup failure, we're going to show you how to avoid the pitfalls that cause 90% of startups to fail. And we'll poke a little fun at Google and illustrate how three products of theirs all fall into market research failures. Remember, this book is about avoiding the most common startup failures before they happen. So I remind you of my opening quote from Robert Heinlein about teaching pigs. Or perhaps you'd prefer J.R.R. Tolkien's version. It does not do to leave a live dragon out of your calculations if you live near one. No matter which speaks to you, do us both a favor and make a plan for success. Don't bother giving a pig a singing lesson or ignoring a dragon when one works next door. Write a darn business plan and address the questions. Is my industry an idiot or attractive? Am I offering a solution to a valid and widespread problem? Am I making assumptions or do I have concrete data to support my venture? Am I codependent or can I stand on my own 2 feet? Is my crystal ball back from the shop? Wait. I'm pretty sure I told you they aren't available yet for entrepreneurial use. So make a bunch of if-then statements and create a plan for being flexible. Don't pigeonhole yourself into thinking too small. I know you can do it. Better yet, I know it won't even take you as long as you think to accomplish these exercises either. Sit down with your co-founders and hash these things out. Your business will be the better for it, and your bottom line and bank account will thank you for putting in the effort.